So tonight we're going to continue talking about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which has a general title for the whole foundation, contemplation of mind objects. And last week we looked at the first of these ways of dividing up experience, which is essentially what they are. And we looked at the five kilesas, the obstructions, and how to work skillfully with them. And tonight we're going to look at the seven factors of awakening, which is, in essence, the counterbalance to the kilesas. But I want to mention, very briefly, that there are two other sets of mind objects that I'm just quite boldly skipping over. That are related to each other, and these two are the what's called the five aggregates of clinging and the six sense spheres. The six sense spheres I've already talked about to a certain extent when we were talking about mindfulness of body, because part of mindfulness of body is taking in all the six sense spheres. And the five aggregates of clinging is just another way, in a sense, to divide up all experience. The actual word aggregate, sometimes actually translated as heaps, piles. So like the five piles of mental stuff would be another translation. These two are similar in that the intention behind the contemplation of them is to take us deeper into understanding not self. Basically, the idea is you look at everything you're experiencing from the point of view of one of these sets of mind objects, and you see that basically everything fits into one of those categories, and there's nothing left over that you could call self. So it's a way of making your mind shift into that understanding of, oh, there's no self here, basically. And that's all I'm going to say about those two. I toyed with the idea of adding more talks to this thing, but there's other things I want to do in November and December, so this is what I did. So I want to first of all read from the sutta. And this is the Buddha's words on the seven factors of awakening. And these are basically seven different mental factors that can arise. And this is what the sutta says. If the mindfulness awakening factor is present in him, he knows there's the mindfulness awakening factor in me. If the mindfulness awakening factor is not present, he knows there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. He knows how the unarisen mindfulness factor can arise, and he knows the arisen mindfulness awakening factor can be perfected by development. So there's like four factors to each of these. And then he lists the others, has identical wording for the other six factors. It was the investigation of Dhamma's awakening factor, the energy awakening factor, the joy awakening factor, the tranquility awakening factor, the concentration awakening factor, and the equanimity awakening factor. So those are the seven factors. And I'm going to go spend most of this evening just talking through the seven. And basically, it starts with, and the first of the seven factors of awakening is mindfulness. What a surprise, huh? This is like what we've been talking about, and this is what the Buddha's been talking about up until now. This is getting quite near the end of the sutta. There is one more section after this, which we'll talk about next week. But this is, so we're getting close to the end. And basically he's saying to start the awakening process, mindfulness must be present. And I want to point out something. It's like, in some sense, we tend, if we're not careful, to think that, you know, doing the noting practice and working concentration and all that stuff, that we're practicing mindfulness, which isn't actually true. What we're actually doing is practicing skillful means such that the mindfulness awakening factor might arise. You see the difference here? Like, we're not practicing mindfulness, because mindfulness is just a mental factor. It arises, it's there for a while, it's gone, like every other mental factor. So all we're doing with our practice is creating, hopefully, the causes and conditions such that mindfulness can arise. Once mindfulness arises, then it leads to the other six factors in a succession. So I thought it would be useful to talk about what mindfulness means. And it's one of this comes from the Pali word sati, and has, you know, actually sati is one of those words that, well, it could be translated this way and it could be translated that way, and it has this sort of flavor if it's used here. And so it's one of those words that isn't simply translated. Mindfulness is the most common one, but here's four qualities of mindfulness that are things that would help us remember. The instruction was to know if it's there or to know if it's not. So four qualities. Not forgetting. Mindfulness means not forgetting. You know, staying firmly with the object, not wandering. So the object is whatever your object of meditation is. In our case, it's the noting practice. In other cases, and there are other things, other forms of meditation practice, even in the Theravadan world, which I'll talk about in a few weeks, actually, that take different mind objects. But in all cases, it's like we're not wandering. We're staying with the program. We're, another sense is like solid. You know, we're like I build things, so I often put posts in the ground for decks and fences and stuff. And that's, I think of it solid in that way. Like, you know, you dig a hole, there's a whole process, there's a skillful means to put a post in the ground, and you go through this process very carefully and very diligently, and there you've got this really solid post that isn't going to move. That's what we're talking about here, not forgetting. We're staying with the object. The mind isn't wandering. Now, another possible translation is presence. Mindfulness is about being present for what's actually happening right now. So another way you could say that is not looking away, or not giving in to the kalesas, not giving into aversion, particularly aversion or desire, getting caught up in wanting not to be here right now. It's the idea of, you know, and it's particularly aversion is what comes up into mind here, because aversion is this energy of, I want to keep my distance from that. I'm not going up close and paying attention to it. I'm sort of standing back and going, nah, not that. This is the opposite of presence. It's absence, as a matter of fact. Here's another translation, remembering. I guess the really great translation, and really, because it reminds us that really what this practice is about, I mean, the actual form of the practice, is simply, really simply, and remembering, we all remember stuff. So it's really simply remembering what we're doing. Right now, we're practicing mindfulness. We're practicing creating the causes and conditions that mindfulness can arise. And just so there we are, we're sitting and we're noting our breath and we're noting other things arising and going away. And then the mind wanders off and we're caught in some story and blah, 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 blah. And at some point, we remember. You know, aha, now I remember. I'm actually sitting here with these people practicing mindfulness. Remembering is a key part of this whole practice, because we're human beings and our minds are going to wander. Absolute guarantee. Wander less, wander more, some days less, some days more, some days, you know, if I can get two breaths in a row in before my mind wanders, it's a good day, right? So, but remembering is that act of going, oh yeah, what I was doing was practicing mindfulness. Finally, the other association that this word sati often has is a strong association with the idea of wisdom and simplicity. You know, there's a famous teacher had this phrase he always used, just sit and know you were sitting. That's all. Just actually know that you're sitting. Because often we're sitting and our mind is nowhere close to knowing that that's what we're doing. We're up on our head someplace. So knowing you're sitting is being staying in the body, being aware of what's arising in the body, the first foundation of mindfulness. But also being aware of that larger sphere of things we've been looking at. And this also means that we don't start making up stories about what we're experiencing. Often that's what happens. We hear something, we taste something, we smell something, we remember something from the past, and then we start making up a story about it. This is the opposite of simplicity. It's making things way more complex. So simplicity is just like, this is what's arising, I note that. So this is what mindfulness is all about. Trying to not forget, to be present, to remember, and to keep things as simple as possible. Yeah. In the refrain that we talked about a few weeks ago, there's that section in the refrain where the Buddha says, just to stay with a mental object as much as is necessary for continuous mindfulness. Just enough, simple. Don't make it into some big fancy project. It just gets in the way. Just stay with the simpleness of the thing. So that's mindfulness. And that's the first of the awakening factors. So we have to actually, mindfulness must be present for the other six factors to arise. And we have to know whether it's present or not. We have to know if it's present, and we have to know if it's absent. And so that's like all those other things we were talking about. You know, there's all those like not so pleasant mental factors we were talking about the last couple of weeks. We have to know if they're present and know when they're absent. Well, same thing here. You know, the Buddha keeps coming back to this idea of both knowing when something is there and when something isn't there or isn't there anymore. You know, we might be quite mindful and still and focused for a while, and then it's gone. Then we remember, hopefully, and then we go back again, because those causes and conditions keep recurring. Once mindfulness has arisen, then the second awakening factor can arise. So notice I'm talking about this being sequential, and it is quite sequential. And the second of these is called Dhammavacaya, which roughly means investigation. But once again, it's not, it's an English word that, because when we think of investigation in English, it's like figuring something out. You know, it's like investing on a private investigator, right? And checks into all these things and follows people, whatever. And that's not what we're talking about here. This is not about figuring things out, which is our whole Western mode of how things, we think everything, we should figure everything out, right? That's, if we can just figure it out, then we can, everything will be okay. Another translation of this, of Dhammavacaya, is once again, wisdom. Oh, there's wisdom again. Wisdom, remember, wisdom is different than knowledge. Knowledge is what our culture praises. basically. If we have lots of knowledge, we're doing good. And instead, the Buddha talks more about wisdom, which is this deeper understanding that isn't based directly on knowledge at all. It's based on experience. So basically what we're talking about here, what is it we're trying to investigate, to be aware of? And most importantly, what we're investigating is the background underneath the mental arisings that are going on. Like, there's lots of stuff going on. We're telling ourselves stories and we're getting distracted by this and that. But if we look underneath, we start to see the actual nature of the mind and the actual nature of what's arising, this underneath pattern, which is basically that everything's impermanent. Everything's unsatisfactory as a way of making us happy. And there's no self there, not self. So we're investigating, we're trying to see the underlying energy of what's arising as opposed to just the details. We're stepping back from the details and looking at the underlying pattern, which allows us to start to really understand that's how everything is. Everything is impermanent. Everything is unsatisfactory. And there's no self involved in anything. The self is an illusion. And sometimes instead of investigation, another translation is discrimination. Not in the sense of being discriminating against somebody, but discriminating is like this clear, precise mental process where I discern what the truth is. And basically, the reason this stands out and why this comes at this point is that this investigation and into the nature of the underlying nature of mind is that it allows us to very clearly see what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. And to steer ourselves very consciously towards what is wholesome. Because often, when we take something impermanent as permanent, because we like it typically, though sometimes because we don't like it so much, it's horrible. And that we make it permanent that way, but often we make things permanent because we want to keep them. Then this tends towards the unwholesome. It tends toward grasping and clinging and getting caught in all those stories about, oh, well, maybe I'm not going to have it tomorrow, and oh, no, and blah, 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 blah. So once we start to see the impermanent nature of everything, then we see the uselessness, in a sense, of grasping anything, of clinging to anything. This is also, this particular mental factor, this factor of awakening, is the antidote to doubt. Interestingly, if we can, because we see things clearly, and then all our doubts about the practice just go away. So this is actually considered a very strong antidote to doubt. So now we've established mindfulness. Mindfulness is there. And then Dhammavacaya has arisen. Then what arises next is energy, virya. Sometimes also translated as effort. And basically, at one level, we're all on our own with this practice. No one can come along and touch us with the magic peacock feather and now we're enlightened, right? We got to do this ourselves. And that requires effort. And it's tricky effort because if we put too much effort, if we push and push and push and push, we get tight and we strive, that isn't wholesome. It gets in the way, it actually shuts down mindfulness, it turns it off. On the other hand, if we don't put enough effort, it gets things to get sort of loosey-goosey, lackadaisical. That doesn't work either. So we're trying to find the balance here, but we actually have to be aware that we are actually applying effort. This is something we actually note. These are all mental patterns, mental factors that we can note. Okay. This is, by the way, an antidote to sloth and torpor, another one of those kilesas we talked about last week. Putting in effort turns off the energy of sloth and torpor. It's like consciously choosing, all right, let's do this. And interesting, here's other translations of the word virya are strength and courage. Courage, I think, is a really interesting one because it means, yeah, to do this practice takes courage. This is not your ordinary way of living in the world based on what our culture thinks. And often takes us in the opposite direction from what our culture thinks. Simplicity, valuing wisdom over knowledge. I mean, these are not our cultural beliefs. And so there's a certain amount of courage involved in this process, that the courage to say, all right, this is where I'm going to put my energy. Also want to read something else here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. That talks about this energy factor quite directly. And this is called, what he calls it here, is spiritual urgency. The proximate cause for the arising of virya as a factor of enlightenment is the feeling of spiritual urgency. The Buddha talked of attending to these awakening factors as a matter of vital concern and not simply as something to do in our off hours. There are some powerful reflections that remind us of this urgency. We can reflect on the preciousness of our present circumstances. Whether we think of it in the context of many lives or just in this life, we can see and appreciate how rare it is for all the conditions to come together in order for us to hear the Dhamma, and even more so, to have the interest, motivation, and opportunity to practice. This is rare. Look out in the world. What's going on in the world out there? What you're doing is this part of this is part of that courage thing I was talking about. This is a rare thing. And we actually also, aren't we lucky to have this opportunity? I feel incredibly grateful to be able to teach. Sometimes it's like, oh my God, what a joy to be able to do this. But if I was part of half the world that doesn't have enough food or a decent place to live or enough money to take care, get their children to go to a decent school or take your pick of all the things that are not so great in the world, I wouldn't have this opportunity. I'd be just scrabbling to get a square meal on the table and a roof over my head for me and my family. We're incredibly fortunate and privileged. And we need to be aware of that and understand that that's the truth of things. How lucky we are to be able to sit here and do what we're doing. And because of that, we often think that conditions will always be favorable, but look at the world around us reveals the truth of uncertainty, from war and violence to natural disasters to our own aging bodies. What wise reflection on the uncertainty of conditions heightens the appreciation of our present circumstances and thus becomes the cause for the arousal of energy. You know, we start to see, when we start to really see impermanence, we start, for instance, we start to say, oh, wait, this is impermanent too. I can't forget that. We'll talk more about that next week, but it wakes us up. Who knows? My old teacher, Swami Vishnu, had this great thing he used to do that at the time used to just drive us crazy, but he had a good intent behind it. He'd ask this question to say, what's the difference between yesterday and today? You know, and people who didn't know him that well, who were new to the Sangha, would say things like, well, you know, yesterday was Wednesday and today is Thursday, or it was raining yesterday and today it was sunny, or just, you know, all these sort of things. And he'd say, no. The difference between yesterday and today is today we're all one day closer to death. And we'd all go, oh, Swamiji, so depressing, you know. But he was trying to wake us up. Hey, trying to awaken spiritual urgency in us. Because who knows what's going to happen tomorrow to this body or to our life or to this town, or who knows, right? Now is our opportunity to practice. We have these ideal conditions to practice right now. We want to put as much energy as we can into the practice while we have this opportunity. Okay. So then we come to the next of the fourth of these factors. So we have mindfulness established. We're open to the underlying process of what's going on. We're investigating. We're putting in energy. We're applying energy to the practice. Then what arises is something called pitti. Pitti roughly translates, once again, as rapture, which is a translation I'm not particularly comfortable with. It has too much association, perhaps because of my youth, in that sort of charismatic rapture, you know, speaking in tongues stuff. I was actually involved in a charismatic church that had channeling of entities and all kinds of stuff once upon a time in my life. And the word rapture it's one of those words that sets me off because of that. So a word I prefer more is joy. It's a pretty good word, actually. And because it indicates that we need to actually enjoy the practice. We need to actually feel joy arising as we practice. And so it's like another way of looking at this is that joy arises because we develop an intense, powerful interest in what's arising. It isn't just, oh, well, now there's that, now there's this, ho-hum. It's like, wow. And there should be a wow factor in your mind. So I'm like, wow, look at that. You know, that thought was there, and it came, and then it's gone. Wow. You know, it's like, you have to sort of have that excitement. And this leads to, pity is what leads to deeper states of concentration. It also can be, when this mental factor is strong, quite pleasant in a way that is pleasant in ways that nothing else I know of comes anywhere close. It's a totally different thing. We have to be careful here because we're not talking about sukha, which is often said to be the opposite of dukkha. You know, we all know what dukkha is, right? Suffering. Sukha is like, it's also often translated as joy or happiness, but this is worldly happiness. happiness that arises when, you know, you get coconut ice cream for dessert, like I had tonight. It was great. It gave me joy. It made me happy to eat that stuff. You know, but pity is otherworldly. It rises, this energy, this joy arises strictly at the mental level. It's a mental factor that arises, and it just, it's so obvious when it's there. That's the best I can say. It's like, wow, when that energy is there, it's like, oh yeah, that's pity. Yep, I recognize that one. You know, it's like really clear. But it arises because we've established mindfulness, we've investigated, opened our mind to the possibilities of things, we've put in energy, and then this pity arises. This is an antidote to desire and aversion. Because now all the joy we need is arising purely at the level of mind. We don't need anything else. As long as we don't cling, there's the problem, of course. As long as we don't start practicing to have that wonderful pity state arise again. You know, we don't turn the practice into a bliss machine, which is dangerous and common, actually. You can be quite profoundly trained in mindfulness, but you get stuck right here because the joy, the bliss is so strong that you stop practicing. And you think this is the answer. I'm just going to hang out in this blissful state all the time. Now you're stuck. You're clinging to this mental factor. So we have to watch for that. But having said that, this is a wonderful thing. I want to read a poem that describes this quite well. You know me and poetry. So this is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's called Touch Me, because it describes this pity energy quite well. Touch me as if you seek to find the core of my desire. Come to me like wind before a summer storm. Blown open, I close no doors against the breeze. Dance with me beneath the low clouds. Find me within you, above you, beside you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. Not self, clearly expressed. That's what we're talking about here with pitti, that sort of experience. But this is only step four, this is only factor four. And the thing is, once mindfulness is established, we've now talked about three factors that all get more and more energetic, right? Investigating actual energy itself, and then this pity, this rapturous state of joy. They're all outflowing energetic. And so the next three balance that out and are essential parts of the process. So once the first four are there and you can experience them, you know they're there, you can note them, then the next thing that comes is pasati, which means tranquility. Let's calm things down a little here, basically, right? It's an emotional calmness. It's like the ability to see strong emotional states arise in the mind and not get caught with them. But they just don't hook us at all anymore. They just come and go because we have this calm, steady base that's built on top of all this energy produced by the earlier factors. This is an antidote. to restlessness and worry, which, you know, restlessness, remember, is being agitated and jumping around, and this is the opposite of that. When pasadi arises, it's very, very distinct, both on the mental level and, interestingly enough, in my experience, on the physical level as well. You just become incredibly still. If you're following the breath, it's interesting because the breath pretty much stops sometimes. It's like it's there, but it's so subtle, it's even hard to detect your breath. You're still breathing. It's not like you're, you know, slipping into some weird body state, just as the breath has become very, very, very subtle. This is also, by the way, why we spend, in many meditative traditions, we emphasize stillness of the body as part of the practice. If we can stay still, physically still in the body, then this mental calmness is much more likely to arise, which is why it's so much the opposite of restlessness and worry, which are very agitated physically as well, typically. And so this is why I would encourage you, if you want to play with this, where you can actually decide, all right, for this sitting period, I'm going to be perfectly still. And very consciously note desires to move arising and deciding, no, I'm not going to move. I decided at the start of this sitting period to be perfectly still. And so that's what I'm going to do. That's totally within, because intention to move is just a mental formation that arises long before you actually move. So you can choose to tend towards this physical stillness, which leads to this emotional calm that's built on top of. And then you can do that because you've put all this energy into it through the first four steps. Then what comes along after that, the sixth factor is samadhi, which in Pali simply means concentration. Samadhi in Sanskrit has all kinds of other connotations, none of which apply here. This is simply, it means concentration. So once the first five factors are there, then truly deep concentration arises. And the mind is incredibly steady and one-pointed. It's like, it's just staying with the object of meditation. Just staying there, really steadily for a long period of time. And I do want to carefully point out that there are really two different modes of concentration. The noting process, having the object of meditation change based on what's actually arising in the mind, is one mode. You know, sort of an active mode of concentration, where the actual object of concentration is shifting all the time, or seemingly, because we start to see underneath, we just see there's different manifestations of the same energy of impermanence. The other form of concentration is to pick a particular object of concentration. It could be a mantra, which is a form of practice I did for a long time. It could be visualization. It could be some sort of prayer. It could be, in the Theravada tradition, there's a practice called metta, loving kindness practice, which has actually a set of phrases you keep repeating. So it's this form of concentration is very repetitive. It has a much firmer, simpler form. It's one-pointed, mantra might be 3 or 4 syllables, 5 syllables, some mantras, you know, longer, 18 syllables, but simple. These are just different forms of concentration practice. I'm not saying one's better than the other. Even within the noting practice, as I've said many times, if we just reduce our noting to simply what's the breath, just the rise and fall of breath, and consciously choose to narrow our focus in a sense to just the breath. This is a concentration practice that has a very, very simple object of meditation. Just the fact that you're breathing. So even within the noting world that we've been talking about, the Vipassana world we've been talking about, there are forms of this practice that are tend more towards a very, very simple form of concentration. Now, the question obviously is, well, which one of these two is better? And the answer is both. I've practiced in both forms over my life. They both work. Sometimes I am drawn more in one direction, sometimes I'm drawn more in another direction. They're both very powerful. It's just something like everything else you practice. But I want to make sure that you understood that concentration is a pretty broad world in terms of different objects of concentration you might choose. In all of this, if all six of these are present, then what arises, the seventh factor of awakening, is upekkha, which roughly translates as equanimity. This is an evenness of mind. It's different from pasati. Pasati is sort of more withdrawn in a sense. It's calm and still, but it's sort of enclosed somewhat. Whereas upekkha is wide open, but calm. It's that balance, incredible balance of mind, where there's neither wild elation or depression, or anything, you know, pick your synonyms for those words. It's like, this is the end point in terms of mental factors in this sutta. This is where we're heading, is towards reaching this state of equanimity, where things are just, you're wide open, your heart is wide open, you're taking in things, but you're not ever being thrown. The interesting thing is equanimity is also something that the Buddha talks about a lot, not just in the seven factors of awakening. In two other of his famous lists, right, the Buddha's famous for lists, the four Brahma Viharas, the noble abodes, the mental arisings that we can cultivate, wholesome mental arisings we can cultivate, upekkha is the last of them. It ties all the others together. And there's another teaching called the 10 Paramis, which I talked about in the spring. And sure enough, the last of the 10 Paramis is upekkha, equanimity. So this is like, in some sense, the end point of the mental process itself is this steadiness of mind. Okay, so I have to be careful not to talk much longer. So I want to read one more thing, and then we're going to sit. And this is from Anileo again. And he's actually summarizing and talking about the sequential nature of these awakening factors. And I want to remind you, these are just mental factors that you can actually note. If you start paying attention to them, you can actually see them and also note when they're not there, which is fair. But it's something where you can actually see which ones are present and how many of them are present. It's an interesting layer of the practice. But here's what Anileo has to say. Practically applied, the whole set of the seven awakening factors can be understood to describe the progress of Satipatthana practice to this level of deep equanimity. On the basis of well-established mindfulness, one investigates the nature of subjective reality. One sustained investigation gains momentum through energy. With growing insight, the object of contemplation becomes clearer and the meditator feels inspired to continue with the practice. There's joy, right? If at this point the danger of getting carried away by elation and agitation can be avoided, there's the warning flag again. Continued contemplation leads to a state of calmness where the mind stays effortlessly with its meditation object without succumbing to distraction. In other words, concentration has arisen. With maturing insight, this process culminates in a state of firm equanimity and detachment. It is at this point when the inspired momentum of mindful investigation takes place against the background of tranquil composure that the mental equipoise needed for the breakthrough to awakening comes about. Hence the name, the seven factors of awakening. Once these factors are all present, then that shift into awakening can occur, or so I've been told. Nothing. I'm not speaking from experience anymore. I'm speaking from what Analeo has to say. But it's like these very step by step lead to that place where now that breakthrough into an awakened state, whatever that means, can actually occur. And so, in a sense, what we want to do is learn to start paying attention to these things to see that they're there. It's also, by the way, very encouraging when you see that they are there. It's what encourages you to keep practicing, as Analeo implied in his summary there. So these are mental factors. They are the wholesome, positive mental factors that are the balance to the kalesas, which we talked about last week. And that's enough of me talking for now. So what I'd like to do now is let's sit for about half an hour. So once again, you want to find that comfortable seated position. Remember, if you're listening to this as a recording, that you should, when I finish talking, pause your recording, sit for 30 minutes, and then turn it back on for the concluding portions of this evening. So once you're seated, you've steadied the breath, perhaps. Close your eyes. And then just be open to what's arising. And just remember over and over again what you're doing. Stay steady. Stay firm on the object of meditation, the noting process. Every 3 or 4 seconds, you just note what's most prominent. Remembering that if there's nothing that sticks out, you can always go back to the breath being the anchor of the process. And we'll just sit for 30 minutes or so. It's one other thing I want to really emphasize, because it's actually quite important. When I was talking earlier about virya energy and how important it was, because we have to do this ourselves, it has to be our energy that we apply, our physical energy, our mental energy. Because in the end, this whole practice is, we have to do this for ourselves. At the same time that's true, there's a totally opposite, in a sense, that's also true, and that's the importance of Sangha, the importance of practicing with others and having people you practice with that even in the simplest way, like this evening, as people were coming into the room, people were just saying hello to each other. It was nice. It was like very sweet, just to sort of make that little connection. And we wave to each other. We say goodnight afterwards. That idea of Sangha is a support that allows us to keep going. It's the Buddha emphasizes this over and over and over again. And I'm not going to dig into the sutta and read you suttas, but it's very clear that the Buddha feels that that Sangha, association with like-minded people who are also practicing, is an extremely important part of the practice. It helps us create that energy we need. And so I want to finish, and I know I'm sure some of you have heard me read this poem before, but it's probably one of my favorite poems from Dana Falls. It's called What a Surprise, Sangha. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries and let us never lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fire in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to focus our desire on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take one step is courageous. To stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for your kind attention. I'll see you all again soon. Next week is the last week of this series, and I'll talk next week about what's coming after. But we have one more week on the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So have a good sleep, a good evening, have a good weekend. We'll see you all soon.
Good night. Thanks. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Barry.
Happened. I didn't leave. Oh, there it is.